You're listening to KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Peaceworks Community Radio in Eugene, Oregon, and simulcasting at www.kepw.org.
Countdown to the new year with Dylan, Grateful Dead, Hendrix, Zero, and more. This Thursday night, Hard Rain and Slow Trains at 8, Deadish at 9. Let's give 2020 a big kick out the door and usher in the new year on KEPW.
Talk is cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti. This is KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. Please support independent media, more so now than ever. All right, so today I've got several interviews coming up here, but it's the first of the year. And I'm going to do something controversial. I'm going to start the year controversially. This is Hedy Epstein talking about Israel and Palestine. She's a famous activist. This was recorded in Los Angeles in 2002, I believe. She's since passed away. So she describes her experience at the hands of Israeli security. All right, so a little disclaimer here. First of all, the opinions on this show are not that of the Eugene Peaceworks or KPW or the staff or anybody here. My take on Israel has always been that it's the military-industrial complex and oil interests that are using Israel as a pawn. And I use that word pawn. I hope it's not offensive to Jewish people to say that Israel is being used as a pawn, but I think, and I've stayed off the BDS stuff because it's being co-opted by the extreme right. So I've stayed off this issue, but it's become kind of important. So I'm going to do a second disclaimer here when I come back and elaborate on what I'm talking about now. And then play you a little bit of Hedy Epstein about her experience at the hands of Israeli security back in the early 2000s. All right, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. Listen to our newscast. And Happy New Year. KEPW-LP, 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. right, this is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Sesti. I just want to reiterate this show, the opinions on this show are not that of the staff or Eugene Peaceworks or anybody else. So, Israel has become an issue during the Trump administration, even more so. And so, and like I say, it's mainly the military-industrial complex and the it's not Israel that's the problem. It's the military-industrial complex and oil interests, but even more so weapon sales. So, they're talking about a $750 billion budget, military budget. That doesn't include the $8 billion a year around that we give to Israel that they then buy weapons with. That's not included in the $750 billion. Okay, so what Hedy Epstein did at the beginning of her lecture is she said if anybody is disrespectful about to her, that she would turn around. So, you know, you can't say something like that to me and just leave that lie. So, of course, at the end, my question to her was, is it ethical to, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember exactly what I said. I have it on tape, but I'm not going to play that for you. Basically, I said that is it ethical to just blame Israel without even discussing, isn't it taking it out of context to discuss Israel without talking about the military-industrial complex, weapons sales, and oil interests? And so she turned around, and the entire audience went, because most people agreed with what I was saying. So someday I'll play that for you, but I just don't want to play that this week. So, Yemen, Syria, the Ukraine, all these are wars that are going on there. People are dying. And Israel, too. I'm going to try and get in touch with the Freedom Flotilla. I've got Jewish Voices for Peace. I'm trying to get a hold of them. Because there's a lot of Jewish people that are against what Israel is doing in Palestine. And it's mostly to sell weapons and, you know, it's hegemony for oil. So, I listened to Coast to Coast. I listened to a lot of radio. And I'm going to talk about Justin Bieber. Let me just play you this. Opinion. These are my opinions.
Opinion.
So, I listened to a lot of different radio, including the popular music stations while I'm driving and overnight. I listened to Coast to Coast. And they had, you know, the Nostradamus guy doing conspiracy theory. And even the Nostradamus guy was talking about the atrocities in Yemen. And he went as far as to say that these are, corporate interests for oil is what these wars are about. So even – and so, you know, there's a concept called Isaac Asimov wrote a book, The Foundation Series, and he's talking about psychohistory. And that's what these guys, that's what this Nostradamus guy, a lot of these prophecy guys are doing, is they're using, there's patterns that you can see in history. And so the guy can predict this stuff. It's easy to predict what's going to happen because all you have to do is look at the corporate interests in these areas and you can predict what's going on. And the other concept that I've noticed is the Israel issue seems very complicated, but it's actually, like I say, just about military-industrial complex and oil interests. And you can tell a classic CIA operation when you can't tell the players without a program. And when they're playing a bunch of people off one another, these are classic CIA tactics. So anytime there's an issue like that, just look at the corporate relationship and the corporate interest and the extraction economy angle. And you'll understand the issue, and put aside all the other stuff that is just propaganda, usually set by the CIA and NSA and all those other acronyms. All right. So one other thing before I get to Hedy Epstein, could someone please stop Justin Bieber? Please stop him. The guy's been off my radar. I don't even hear him. He's probably the guy that I change the station every time I hear him. But now he's got this song where he is rhyming holy with hold me, And he's got this religious message. I guess the message of the song is not to be judgmental. But please, if you're a Justin Bieber fan, just please stop him. Stop him. He's irritating everyone. And his song is being played all the time. I suggest that we just shave his hair off and use it as kindling to burn all of his records. But, you know, his stuff is still in the cloud, so that won't work. But, I mean, it's ironic that Cat Stevens records, they want to burn Cat Stevens records, but they let this guy go. So please, somebody please stop Justin Bieber. All right, so here is, as promised, Hedy Epstein. Let's see if this thing's going to work. The auxiliary. Sorry, we've changed the mixing board here. And please support independent media if you can. So what she's saying here is her parents, she's actually from, was her parents escaped Nazi Germany.
Which was about the same time that Israel became a state. And I had some mixed feelings at that time. On one hand, I was very pleased that now there was a place where those who survived the Holocaust would be able to go to, because maybe they were no longer able to return to their place of origin, or maybe didn't wish to go there anymore. But on the other hand, remembering my parents' ardent anti-Zionism, I thought somewhere down the road, no good is going to come of this new state. What that might be, that no good might be, I couldn't possibly imagine at the time. But I was new in this country. There were new impressions and new things to learn. And so Israel was really on the back burner of my interest, and remained there for a very, very long time. And then in 1982, I got a wake-up call, because at that time, I learned that there had been two horrible massacres in two refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, which were located in Lebanon. And I needed to find out what that was all about, why it happened, and what has really taken place between 1948, when Israel became a state, and 1982, when Israel was responsible for these awful massacres. And the more I learned, and the more I understood, the more I began to speak out publicly about my dismay and my opposition to the policies and practices of the Israeli government vis-a-vis the Palestinian people. And then let's go fast forward to September of 2003. I participated in a weekly vigil that we've been holding in St. Louis, where I live, against the war in Iraq. And a friend of mine, Diane, was standing next to me, and she said, "Ask me, have you ever thought about going to Palestine?" And I was absolutely amazed by my response, which was, "Yes, I'm going." What did I just say? I had made no plans, as far as I knew, to go to Palestine. But apparently, subconsciously, maybe in my head, I was preparing myself for that. And then, just a couple months later, Diane and two other women from St. Louis and I found ourselves in Palestine in December of 2003. When we arrived at the airport, we expected to be met by a young man, also from St. Louis, who had been there since October of 2003, and he said he was going to meet us at the airport. And we looked and looked, and we couldn't find him anywhere. And so we called him on his cell phone and left a message saying, "Mark, we're at the airport, we looked for you, we couldn't find you, so we're going to go on to the place where you have arranged for us to stay the first night that we're in East Jerusalem." And we went outside and we went into a van that was going to take us to our destination. And that van only leaves when it's full. And so we're sitting there for a little while waiting for some more people to come. When our phone rang, we said, "Ah, Mark is calling." But no, it wasn't Mark. At the other end of that phone, there was an Israeli captain, and he identified himself by name and rank, and said, "We have Mark. We're interrogating him. Where are you? Where are you going?" And we quickly hung up, because if they're interrogating Mark, and we tell them where we are or where we're going, what are they going to do with us? They're going to interrogate us also. And so we hung up very quickly, and we're very concerned about what is happening to Mark. Mark and his Palestinian driver and Palestinian friend were at a checkpoint, were detained. They went through Mark's backpack and found some very subversive literature in there, a UNESCO bulletin or a leaflet. Mark and the Israeli driver and his Israeli friend were detained for 13 hours, were blindfolded and handcuffed, and were treated pretty badly, especially the two Palestinians. So this was our welcome to Israel. We caught up with Mark after he was released and he told us what had happened. We aligned ourselves with the International Solidarity Movement, or ISM. And if you do that, you need, before you do anything at all, you need to undergo 2 days of rigorous nonviolent training. And the word nonviolent is repeated almost ad nauseum. And you are asked that no matter whom you meet, no matter what situation you encounter, you're to respond non-violently. If you can't do that, then you cannot be associated with ISM. And after the 2 days training, we were accompanied by someone, a young man from Oregon. His name was Jonathan. And Jonathan had been in the village of Jayush, which is northwest of Jerusalem, for quite some time, and had worked with the people in the village. And he took us to Jayush. We arrived late in the afternoon, around 4:30, when Jonathan made a phone call to someone and said, "We have four women here, they're tired, they're hungry, and they need a place to stay. Can you put them up?" And the person at the other end said, "Sure, bring them right over." I wonder how many of us, if we get a phone call at 4 o'clock or 4:30 in the afternoon and are asked to house four people, how many of us are going to say, "Sure, bring them right over"? Many of us, and maybe myself included, might say, "Well, I have a meeting tonight, and tomorrow morning I have an appointment, blah, 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 and I can't do it." But that is not what happens in Palestine. The Palestinian hospitality that we experienced on that day and many, many times afterwards is unlike any that I've ever experienced anywhere. Many of the Palestinians that we stayed with had literally practically nothing. And yet they shared that nothing with you and make something out of that nothing. Jayush is a very, very old community. Many of the homes there are built on former Roman, on old Roman ruins. In fact, the farmers there, or the people there, refer to the olive trees as Roman trees because they are that old. They're 1,000 years old, or maybe even older. The next morning, we were taken to where there wasn't a wall, but there was a high electrified fence and topped off with razor wire. And there was a long line of people because they had been informed the day before that the gate in that fence would be open at 9 o'clock that morning. But some of the people have been there already since 5 o'clock in the morning because they've learned from past experience that when they're told the gate is going to be open at 9, that doesn't really mean it's going to be open at 9. It may be open at 6 o'clock in the morning, and then it's closed at 9 o'clock. And when we arrived there, on the side of the path, there were some men who had built a fire, and they had brewed some tea. And as soon as they saw us, they invited us over and offered us tea. Again, that's part of that, the Palestinian hospitality that I just described. And finally, shortly before 9, really the gate was unlocked by a couple of Israeli soldiers. And the people were asked to move forward and go come to talk to the soldiers. They had to show their ID. They were asked some questions. And after about 15 minutes, the soldiers started to close the gate, but there was still a long line of people. And they would not let these people go through to the other side, where they were going to go to their land and do whatever they needed to do to take care of the things that they were growing there. And I went over to one of the soldiers and I said, "Why are you closing the gate? Look, there's this long line of people here still. Security." And that seems to be the answer no matter what the situation is. If you ask the question, it's always security. I remember seeing a shepherd with his sheep in the town, and the sheep looked just emaciated. They were just skin and bones. And the reason for that is because the shepherd had not been able to take all his sheep across through the gate to the other side. He was allowed to take some, but then the other sheep were supposed to remain in Jayush. And he couldn't do that. And he said, "You know, these sheep are going to die, and I'm not going to be able to sell them before they die, because who's going to buy a sheep that looks like this?" On another day, also still in 2003, we participated in a demonstration. It was my first demonstration, and that was in the village of Masha. At that time, the gate in the wall had not been opened for 2 weeks, and the farmers had not been able to go to their land and do whatever it was they needed to do. And in this demonstration, Israelis, Palestinians, and internationals took place. And the purpose of this demonstration was to go to the gate, try to open it, not go through it, just symbolically open it. And we marched from the community center in the village to the gate. The Israelis were in front wearing big signs on their shirts saying in Hebrew, "We are Israelis." Behind them were the internationals, and all the way in the back were the Palestinians. The reason the Palestinians were all the way in the back is for their own protection, because it was felt that they are easy targets for the Israeli soldiers to shoot at. And as we got close to the gate, I heard gunshots. And with my American mindset, which really doesn't work there, I thought, oh, the soldiers are shooting in the air, warning, urging us maybe to leave. But no, these gunshots were not in the air. They were directed at us. And one of the very first people to be injured critically was a young man, an Israeli young man by the name of Gilna Amati. Gil had just been released from the military 2 weeks earlier, where he had served his 3 years of mandatory service. Perhaps because of what he saw, or maybe even what he did while in service, he felt it incumbent upon himself to come and oppose what is happening in Masha. I have never in my life seen anyone bleed as profusely as Gilna Amati did. Miraculously, a beat-up Palestinian car appeared, and he was carried into the car and taken off to the local clinic. I was standing right next to one of my travel companions, next to Anne, when Anne said, "Oh, I've been hit." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she picked up her pant leg, and there was a huge piece of shrapnel just below her knee. One of the bullets that the Israelis used was not aimed at people, but it shot in the ground. And when it hits the ground, it explodes, and pieces of shrapnel fly in every which direction. Another Palestinian car appeared, and Anne and the three others of us were in the car, taken to the same clinic where Gilna Amati was being taken care of. And there was a trail of blood leading into the clinic. A woman was mopping up the blood that was literally pouring out of Gil, pouring out faster than she could mop it up. After he was, the doctor there had done what he was able to do, Gil was taken to a hospital in Petah Tikva, which is in Israel, and so was Anne. The first time that I saw the actual wall, not a fence, but the wall, which is 8 meters high or about 27 feet high, a cement wall, was in Qalqilya. And I have a photograph here. I don't know if you can see it way in the back, but the length of the wall, the 27-foot high wall, is the length of this photograph. And there is a little brown figure down there, and that is I. I'm 5 feet tall, so put five of me on top of each other, and that represents the height of that wall. I should really explain, I should have done this earlier, what the maps on this wall are. I don't know that I can take this out. Can I take this out? Thank you very much. You're very helpful. I like your the words on your shirt, too. It says impeach. This map, there are four maps here, and the map on the left shows where what Palestinian land was in 1947, which is before Israel became a state, approximately a year before it became a state. And the dark green areas is the Palestinian land, and the white areas or light green areas is where Jews lived in 1947. The next map is, this is 1946, I'm sorry. The next map is 1947, and the areas where Palestinians live has shrunk considerably. This is the dark green area is where Palestinians live. This is the West Bank, and here is the Gaza Strip. This area, this map is between 1948 and 1967, and the Palestinian land has shrunk some more. And this is 1999, so it is not even up to date. And the dark green areas is where Palestinians live. Here's the Gaza Strip. And you notice that it's no longer contiguous. There are little pockets or bantustans where the Palestinians live, surrounded by Israeli settlements and Israeli land. This map, which also is not up to date, but every one of these blue and black boxes is a checkpoint. And these checkpoints are not at the border, but they are inside the West Bank. So if you want to go from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, you've got to go through several checkpoints. I want to share with you an experience I had at a checkpoint, and it was at the Colombia checkpoint, which is near Ramallah. The four of us wanted to go through the checkpoint and go on to East Jerusalem. Each of us was asked to speak to one of the Israeli soldiers. I was asked to speak to a man who was probably in his late 40s or early 50s. He was in the Israeli Reserve Army. And he looked at my passport and he turned the pages back and forth. And then he said, "Are you Jewish?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, then in a very angry and aggressive tone, said, "Don't you know that every Jew who goes to Ramallah gets cut in half?" And he motioned across his waist. And he repeated that four times. And then he went on and said, "Don't you dare go to Ramallah anymore, because you will be cut in half." We had just come from Ramallah, where we had stayed with two different Palestinian families. I don't think I looked like I was cut in half. I know several years ago when President Johnson had surgery, he lifted up his pajama top and showed the scar. Well, I'm not going to pick up my blouse and show you that I don't have a scar where I allegedly was cut in half. I started talking about the wall. And the wall, by the way, is built, according to the Israelis, for security purposes, and to make sure that the Israeli people are safe and secure. And if Israel wants to build a wall to be for security purposes, they have every right to build such a wall. But they must build that wall on their own land. And that is not what is happening. That wall snakes through the West Bank, sometimes as much as 5 or 10 miles into Palestinian land. And wherever the wall is being built, the aquifers, the water resources, are always on the Israeli side of the wall. I stayed in a village called Bidu, and I was there for about 4 days. And when you turn the faucet on in Bidu, it's not like here, when the water comes out and you can control how much or how little you want. It's drop, drop, drop. And just down the road, maybe a mile or less, is an Israeli settlement with lush green lawns and a swimming pool. But in Bidu, it's very difficult to even fill up a glass of water. And yet somehow the people manage. They're clean. Their men wear snow white shirts. I don't really know how they manage to do that. When I left Israel, the Israeli airport, I should say, in Tel Aviv, in January of 2004, only two of us, four of us went there, but only two of us left at the time. The other two stayed a little while longer. And when we arrived, when Diane and I arrived at the airport, we were immediately separated. Diane was told to go to the right, and I was told to go to the left. And I was trying to understand, you know, why is that? Is it maybe because Diane is Christian, and the Christians go to the right, and the Jews go to the left? I was then told to go to passport control, where everyone has to go to. I turned in my passport and my ticket, which everyone has to do. And the young woman there typed something into the computer. And seemingly, growing out of the floor, there were two men who identified themselves as security. and they wore name tags, but they were turned around. And I asked, what are your names? No response. And they said, come with us. And I said, you know, where are we going? Just come with us. And I had left my carry-on luggage sitting on the floor, and I bent down to pick it up. And they said, don't touch it. We will carry it. And trying to sort of calm myself down, trying to make light of what I realized is a very serious situation, I said, oh, I thought you said you were security. You must be porters. And I was taken to a room across from the passport control, and my passport and my ticket was given to someone behind the counter, and they were talking in Hebrew. I don't understand Hebrew, so I have no idea what they said. And I was told in a nasty tone, there were three chairs saying, sit, and nobody's going to tell me, sit, and I'm going to obey. And so I said, no, I'm going to stand. Pretty soon, another person came in, a young man, with probably two other security people. And he was told in a very polite tone, would you like to sit down? And so he sat down, and I talked to him while this other conversation in Hebrew was going on. And I said, you know, do you speak English? He said, yeah, I'm an American. And I said, why are you here? What's your crime? And he said, I don't know. What's yours? And I said, I don't know. And shortly afterwards, I was told to follow the two security people who carried my luggage to a room that I didn't know where I was, but later found out it's the airport police station. And in that room, is separate, is a little area that's is covered by a curtain, but the curtain doesn't quite cover the entrance. And I was asked to, I was wanted and I was patted down. My shoes were taken from me, taken somewhere probably to be x-rayed. And then I was told to get undressed. And I said, you have no right to ask me to get undressed. Yes, we do. And I said, well, then I want an attorney. And they said, well, you can have an attorney, but you're going to be at the airport detention center until you get an attorney. But they had also taken my phone. So how on earth was I going to get an attorney? Who knew where I was? And where was Diane? I had no idea. Maybe the same thing is happening to her. And so I decided one of us has to at some point get out of here and maybe be able to help the other one. And maybe I'm the one who can help Diane. And so I agreed to get undressed. And that was not all. And then I was told to bend over because they needed to examine me internally. We were detained for 5 hours, and so, of course, we missed our flight. At some point, 3 hours into this, Diane came into the same room where I was, and her eyes were as big as saucers because she thought I was already at the gate, maybe already on the plane. Diane did not experience quite as bad. Her experience wasn't quite as bad as mine. She did not have to get undressed. She was not searched internally. There was, in the same police station, while all this was going on, and my luggage was being examined minutely, there were some other people. For instance, there was a young woman with a baby, and they were going through her luggage minutely, and at some point the baby started to cry, and so the woman wanted to feed the baby. They did not allow her to feed this 7 or 8 months old baby. And I talked to her briefly, and she said, I'm an Israeli, but I live in England, and I came here to visit my family, and I want to go back to England. And I guess because I don't live in Israel, I'm being punished, and that's why they won't let me feed my baby. She was screaming at them in Hebrew again. I didn't know what she said, but I think I could imagine what it was. There was another young man from Spain, and they went through his backpack minutely and then put all his things in a box, and he was only allowed to take his empty backpack on the plane. Everything else was being checked. I was back in Palestine again in the summer of 2004. Again, we participated in the International Solidarity Movement's training, 2 days of training. Maybe you can put it on the table. We went there with a group called Women of a Certain Age 2004, and back there is one of those women. Hi, Mary. Two of the women were not of a certain age. They were the daughters of women of a certain age. The first demonstration that we participated in was in Aram. Aram is almost like a suburb of Jerusalem. And at the time that we were there, the wall that was about to be constructed was not yet up, but the individual panels of that wall were lying on the huge mound of rubble. And that rubble consisted of the homes and businesses that had been bulldozed by a Caterpillar bulldozer, an American-made bulldozer made in Peoria, Illinois, specially designed to tear down homes, to tear down businesses, to tear down olive trees, and paid for with the tax dollars of American citizens, or anyone living in the United States who earns money here. The wall was to be built right down the middle of the main street of Aram. And this demonstration was in opposition of the construction of this wall. And when we got close to Aram, I could hear in the distance drums and bagpipes. And I thought, well, maybe there isn't a demonstration, but maybe there's a festivity of some kind here. And as we got closer, we saw the demonstration was just beginning, led by Palestinian Boy Scouts who were dressed in beautiful white uniforms with gold trim on it. The young ones played the drums, the older ones played the bagpipes. And we marched along the foot of this huge heap of rubble. On top, at the very top of this heap of rubble, were Israeli soldiers, shoulder to shoulder. And at some point, I looked up and I saw them pull the visors over their face. And I thought, they're protecting themselves of something that we are not protected of. And it takes me longer to describe it than it actually happened. And there I saw this huge white cloud coming towards us. And somebody shouted, tear gas. I didn't need to be told that it's tear gas because my eyes were smarting, my throat was hurting. And we all ran back in the direction that we had just come from. Doors that were closed before suddenly opened up. There were young women with china plates that had pieces of onions on it that they were offering to us because onions counteract some of the effects of tear gas. And we ran into a building where there were six little stores. We ran into one of those stores, and the store owner welcomed us and washed us down with water and sprinkled us with perfume to try to counteract the tear gas. And we told him that some of us are Yehudi, that we are Jewish. And he said, it doesn't make any difference to him. And, you know, he and I, that's because I am Jewish, we are supposed to be enemies. But we, and as well as many other Palestinians that I met, then and earlier and later on, we refused to be enemies. The wall in Aram is now up, and people that live on one side of the wall cannot get to the other side of the wall where maybe family lived, wherever their work is. Children can't go to school because their school is on the other side. And does that wall really, that is not in Israel, does it really provide security? I remember speaking to a young 23-year-old Palestinian man, and he was telling me of some of his experiences and so on. And so I asked him, do do you have dreams or do you have nightmares? And he said, I wish I would have nightmares instead of waking up the next morning to nightmares. Another demonstration that we participated in was in Kufr al-Lablan, which is near Tulkarm. The maps are all coming down, I see. They're ashamed of what is happening in Palestine. In Kufr al-Lablan, there were four roadblocks preventing the farmers from going to their land. You could walk around it or climb over this huge roadblock, but they couldn't take their agricultural equipment to go through those roadblocks. And the farmers in that village, the week before we came there, had tried to take down one of those roadblocks, but they encountered Israeli soldiers who used tear gas and live ammunition, and so the people retreated to the village. And so we came there trying to take down one of those roadblocks. That was our goal. And fortunately, there were no Israeli soldiers anywhere near in sight. But we couldn't move this huge, huge roadblock. And so some farm equipment was brought in. But that equipment, I don't know what it was, but it couldn't move this huge roadblock. And then someone came with a bulldozer, not a caterpillar bulldozer, and together with the bulldozer and all of us pushing and pushing against this huge roadblock, we were able to push it over to the side. And there was a great cry of joy coming from the people who were there. A little red car went through, a boy on a donkey went through. And then we said, well, you know, we succeeded in taking down one roadblock. Let's go on to the next one and see if we can remove it. And we removed it, and we removed the third roadblock and the fourth roadblock without any interference, fortunately, from Israeli soldiers. And when we returned to the village, thank you very much, when we returned to the village, there was a huge feast prepared for us by the people who had remained back in the village. The table was literally bending with all the food and the drinks that were on there. And it was located underneath a beautiful grape arbor, and all you needed to do is just reach out and help yourself to grapes. And again, that's your Palestinian hospitality. The people were so grateful for what we had done. And the people who had removed these roadblocks, we were Israelis, Palestinians, and internationals. That grape arbor also protected us from the really hot sun that day. I've been in Palestine four times. The last time was last August. And this time I went with a group organized by the Presbytery in East Iowa, and it was to be a congressional accompaniment tour. But it turned out to be a congressional abandonment tour. The people in Iowa were not able to get any of their congresspeople or aides to go along, but I was able to, or my congressman had assigned one of his aides to go along. But the first time I talked to this man, I thought, he's not going to go. Because he said he would only travel on the El Al airline because that's the only airline that won't be hijacked. And he wanted assurance that he was going to be safe. And I said, you know, nobody can give you that kind of assurance in any kind of a situation. And he said, well, I won't go unless I have that kind of assurance. And so I said, let me ask you some questions. They may seem personal, they're not. I said, are you going to go to bed tonight? And he said, yes. You're going to get up tomorrow morning? Yes. And I said, you know, when you get up tomorrow morning, you're going to be so sleepy and groggy. When you get up, you're going to trip over your own feet, fall down, and break your neck. Can anyone assure you that's never going to happen? And he said, no. And I said, well, that's why we can't give you that kind of assurance. Closer to the time we were ready to leave, I had another conversation with him, and he said, I'm concerned that I might be kidnapped because I have a congressional passport. And I said, what are you going to do with it? Enlarge it and carry it like a sandwich board front and back and parade down the street and say, I have a congressional passport. And 2 days before we're ready to leave, he said he will go, but he will go only to Israel. He will not go to the West Bank. And that's why I then called this a congressional abandonment tour. My congressman was concerned about my safety. And I said, I've been there before, don't worry about me. And he said, well, you know, the American government is concerned about you too. And I said, you know, really? You know, where was the American government when we needed them? You know, when we arrived at the airport the first time and Mark was detained for 13 hours, we called the American consulate. And they said, we can't do anything until after Mark is released because the Israeli government will tell us they don't know anything about him. They don't know where he is or what is happening. And he said, well, let me write a letter. And I said, sure, you go ahead and you write a letter. And I didn't really think it would make any difference. But lo and behold, he wrote a letter. And he wrote a letter to the Israeli ambassador to the United States, to Dan Eilon. And let me just read an excerpt from the letter. And he says, this is to advise you that my constituent, Henny Epstein, and he gives my address, is traveling to Israel and arriving in Tel Aviv on July 30th, 2006. And then he says some things about me. And then he says, I request that your office take appropriate action to ensure that she's well received during her upcoming visit. If there's any assistance that my office can provide on her behalf, I trust you will let me know. And someone from Ambassador Eilon's office called the airport, called the border police at the airport, and lo and behold, unlike all the other times when I arrived or when I left and was detained for several hours, this time I was really welcomed at the airport when I arrived as well as when I left. I was again very cordially treated. One of the people on this congressional abandonment tour that we met on August 4th was the mayor of the town of Beit Umar. He was Hamas elected in October of 2005. And there was another group, an NGO group there when we met with him. It was a long table and he sat at the head of the table. There was no one else there with him. And he spoke to us in English for almost 2 hours and then answered questions. And one of the things that he said to us, aside from the fact that he's been working for a long time with Israeli and international peace groups and was in the process of arranging for former President Carter to visit the village. And he said he's so concerned about his children who are between the ages of 4 and 14, and there are 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls, that he does not want them to hate Israelis, he does not want them to hate Jews. But what do they see? They see the awful things that the Israeli soldiers have done in the village, the awful things that they have done to him personally. And he said, I'm so concerned that they will hate, and I don't want them to hate. By the time I was back in the United States, I learned that on August 24th, in other words, 20 days after we met with him, at 2 a.m. in the morning, 6 Israeli military vehicles surrounded his home and arrested him. They beat him, they handcuffed him, they blindfolded him. He begged that they not do this in front of his wife and his children until they beat him some more. He was taken to a prison in one of the nearby settlements, was treated miserably there. And as soon as I learned about it, I contacted my congressman again, and I told him that what I had learned, that I had met this man personally, and what a wonderful person, gentle, peace-loving person he is. And so once again, my congressman wrote a letter to the Israeli ambassador, to Daniel Heinlein. And I don't know if there's a connection, but
sorry.
3 days after the letter was written, which was hand-carried and faxed to Daniel Heinlein, Bea Alfond was released from jail. I've been in email contact with him since, and he described to me everything that happened when he was arrested. We're getting close to the period where you will be asking questions, and I'm going to have to ask you to speak very loud, but loudly, and the reason for that is...
That's Talk is Cheap for this week. You've been listening to Hedy Epstein talking about her... experiences with Israeli security. So again, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is mostly about oil interests and the military-industrial complex. It's not the fault of Israel. At least that's my disclaimer on that. Yeah, all you have to do is follow the money. All right, thanks for listening. Up next, 80 Grit.
Hi, I'm Riley.
And I'm Kaylin.
And you're listening to...